This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is December 15th in the year 2000. I'm in the Steenbach Library Conference Room with Dean Emeritus August Lemberger of the School of Pharmacy, and we're here to talk about his career at the university. Let's begin a little bit at the beginning and get some background. Dean Lemberger, could you talk briefly about your childhood and your early schooling?
I was born and raised in Milwaukee. I went to a parochial school, St. Anne's Grade School, and then Marquette University High School. There were five children in the family. I was the third of five. My dad was a pharmacist, and these were the Depression years when I was growing up. But because of his occupation, we survived the Depression pretty well. Mm-hmm.
Before we get to your father's pharmacy, could you talk for a moment about any grade school or high school teachers that you had who might have
Well, I had the one high school teacher that stands out in my memory was Mr. Fountain, who was a math teacher. I think the thing that he showed me as a teacher was that you work hard at teaching, but then your ability to keep your mind going is affected positively by taking a break from it. I can remember in math class, we used to work hard at learning concepts, and then he would pull out a book, and at that time, Damon Runyon was a very popular author and humorous kind of essays, and he would read to the class for maybe 10 minutes or so, 5 minutes, just to kind of break things, and then we'd go back and continue to learn. And I thought that was a pretty effective teaching technique.
I had a grade school teacher who used to read us Freddy the Pig chapter if we were extremely good in fourth grade, I think it was something like that, and I still remember Freddy the Pig. Okay, let's go to your father operating the pharmacy in Milwaukee. Could you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Well, his pharmacy was a professional pharmacy, that is, a prescription only. It was located on the 13th floor of a professional building in downtown Milwaukee. The building was on Wisconsin Avenue and Milwaukee Street. At the time that Dad started his pharmacy, the building was occupied primarily by physicians. In fact, his career started, he worked for a group of physicians as a technician, and they encouraged him to actually set up his own pharmacy. But the thing was, at that time, this was in the 1920s and 30s, the expert physicians, the specialists, were all downtown, and the general practitioners were the ones that were located out in the community. It was after World War II that the trend began where physicians got together in small groups and set up their own buildings and their own clinics and started moving out. As a matter of fact, that had a very adverse effect on the pharmacy because by late 1950s, most of the physicians that Dad worked with had retired. And as they moved out, they were replaced by insurance companies and lawyers, and they don't prescribe very much.
And here he is on the 13th floor.
I had a brother who was also a pharmacist, who at that time was working with Dad, and so they opened another professional pharmacy out in a building with about 15 physicians where they had worked that out. So. But that, you know, became a kind of evolutionary thing with both with medical practice and pharmacy practice.
When did you yourself consider becoming a pharmacist?
That was actually, I think, I know I was in high school, just where I was, whether it was a sophomore, junior, what it was. You know, again, as a Depression baby, you pretty well decided what you were going to do.
Right, very different.
Before you finished high school, and Dad had each of us. There were three boys in the family. He had each of us work in his pharmacy as soon as we turned 16, because at that time, when you were 16, you could be registered with the State Board of Pharmacy as an apprentice, which gave you official kind of status in the pharmacy. Otherwise, you couldn't be in there. And so we had each of us go through the pharmacy just to see what it was like. And I did that in high school, working after school.
What kind of things did you do?
Well, mostly it was stocking the prescription containers in the shelves. I did deliveries downtown, did deliveries to doctors' offices. But then I was also allowed to watch the pharmacists as they compounded, and once in a while, if it was not an individual prescription, but something that was being prepared for the bulk stock of the pharmacy, why, they would let me kind of get involved or punch out capsules or do something like that. So it was a good experience, and I decided that that was a life that I could enjoy very much.
Before we bring you to Madison to school, where had your father received his training?
Well, at the time that Dad became licensed as a pharmacist, there wasn't... You could become licensed with 5 years of apprentice training, and if you could pass the state board examination, you became licensed. There was no educational requirement per se. But Dad did go in the 1910 to 20, in that time period, Marquette University had a short program in pharmacy, and I think it was a six-month course, which my dad took. And then he did his necessary experiential education, that apprenticeship, and then became licensed as a pharmacist. Mm-hmm. I can remember as a kid that Dad, the pharmacists that worked for him, a couple of them, that he tutored them. They became licensed by their experience and then taken to state board. And I can remember on Sunday evenings, they'd come to the house, and Dad and the pharmacist would kind of closet themselves in the living room, and Dad would go over stuff and quiz them and so on.
It's kind of a combination apprenticeship, mentorship.
That's right.
Kind of thing.
Yeah,
oh, that's great.
Right.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the 1930s that requirement for licensure included a degree in pharmacy. And that was, at that time, it was a 4-year pharmacy course plus, and you had to have a year of apprenticeship.
Mm-hmm.
And
internship or whatever.
Well, at that time it was referred to as apprenticeship, which is really all it was. It was a matter of just working in a pharmacy for a year. And it wasn't, you know, when you say internship to me, that's a little more formal, with a little more structure and a little, you know, more specified objectives, education objectives.
We will be talking about that in just a little bit later on. So you entered UW in the fall of 1943. Had you considered any other colleges?
Actually, I entered in the summer of 1943.
Oh, okay.
I graduated from high school. I was 17 and graduated last week in May, and the next Monday morning I enrolled in the summer semester here in Madison. And because of that, I was a little bit late. I was a few days late getting in, but I managed to get enrolled. And so I finished the semesters. At that time, during World War II, the university was on a three-semester
right,
a year
yes
basis.
It was. Yeah.
So I completed a semester of work in the summer and actually got in three semesters. I turned 18 in January and then was drafted the following summer. So I got three semesters of my education completed before I went into the service.
Yeah, so you went to school for a few years, then you went into the service for 2 years, and then you came back and you completed your education.
That's
here
right.
In 48,
yeah.
What was it, 46 to 48, something like that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, 46
yeah.
to 48.
Yeah. Okay, you were asking about whether I had considered any other schools,
right.
and the fact of the matter is, no, I hadn't, both for personal financial reasons, I think, and because the School of Pharmacy at Wisconsin was recognized as a very strong institution. Mm. So that was never even a question.
Right, right.
And I had, I mentioned earlier, I had a brother who was a pharmacist. So he was already at the university and was completing his work before he got drafted. So, you know, it was familiar to come here because Max, my brother, was here. And he lived at the Alpha Chi Sigma fraternity house. And so I moved in and was in the same housing with him. And it was a very comfortable shift for me.
Was that Alpha Chi Sigma, was that a general fraternity? Did it specialize in?
No, Alpha Chi Sigma was a professional chemistry fraternity.
Okay.
At the time, during the war, of course, there weren't very many male students on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And so Alpha Chi Sigma kind of let down the barriers to pharmacy students. Prior to that time, pharmacy students weren't eligible for Alpha Chi Sigma membership. But when they looked over the amount of chemistry in the curriculum for pharmacy, and recognizing the practicality of the situation, why it became possible for us to become members of that fraternity.
So you had your brother Max advising you on pharmacy courses, and you had people from chemistry talking to you about chemistry. That must have been...
That's right. As a matter of fact, it was an eye-opener for me, you know, a 17-year-old kid that had never been out of Milwaukee, to come because of the situation at the time. Most of the fellows that were at that fraternity house were graduate students. Mm-hmm. And they were in disciplines that, at the time, warranted deferment. Mm. Mm. So they were chemistry majors, biochemistry, chemical engineering, and so on. And it was the first time I realized that there was such a thing as graduate education. Mm. I had anticipated my education, I thought pharmacy and get my degree and get license and practice pharmacy was the end of it. But seeing graduate education is what really created in me the thought that, gee, I could go on and get a degree, and then I could teach or do something like that.
As an undergraduate, let's just talk about those years for a few moments, in both sections of it, the before and after the war. Were there any professors or courses, either outside of your field or especially within your field, that... that had an influence on you, that really got you thinking?
Well, the one course that I think of before I went into the service that was not a pharmacy course, it was the first semester I was here, I enrolled in zoology, 5-credit course, and it was taught by Professor Nolan. And here again was, I think, one of the outstanding teachers mm-hmm. of the university.
Yes, he was.
So my exposure was great. I really admired the way he conducted his classes, and I remember him. That's certainly
he was a good
one
teacher,
person.
Right?
Excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. What about within the field?
Well, actually, in that freshman year or that first 3 semesters, I didn't have that. The only pharmacy course per se that I had was an orientation course, mm-hmm. which was 1 credit a week taught by Dean Ewell. Hmm. At that time, Professor Ewell, he wasn't dean until 1950.
Right.
But other than that, well, I did take 1 semester of organic chemistry. The organic chemistry was a real tough course for anybody, and particularly in pharmacy. The teacher of that course at the time was a fellow by the name of Melvin Dunker. And because so many kids failed organic chemistry, he was known by the students as Dunker the Flunker.
And go ahead. Anything else about them? What about other courses? Anything? Teachers? Anyone else? Or
At that time, I can't really say anything stands out or okay. comes to mind.
Did you have an internship or that you did as an undergraduate?
Well. As an undergrad, as I was saying, I was registered as an apprentice in my dad's
pharmacy. Okay, right.
And so I, between working after school in high school and some summers in high school, plus working a little bit while I was in at the university before and after being in the service, I completed that year of apprenticeship requirement before I got my degree. Mm-hmm. So as soon as I graduated, I was eligible to take the state board examination for licensure.
Did you have to write any kind of senior thesis or anything like
no,
that?
No, there was, I know in the timetable or in the book that's listed, and it was a requirement up through the early 1940s, but after the war, it was dropped as a requirement, probably largely motivated by the fact that there was such an influx of returning veterans and enrollment mm-hmm. in the school expanded so dramatically that it was just impossible for that small faculty to try to have a significant experience for a student as an undergraduate thesis. So it was dropped as a requirement.
In the yearbook, your list, 1948 Badger yearbook, it talks about you as belonging to the American Pharmaceutical Association. Well, several different things. We can probably go through them one at a time. The American Pharmaceutical Association. What was the nature of your involvement there? Was that standard?
It was pretty much standard. It was a student branch The American Pharmaceutical Association is a national professional society for pharmacists. Mm. And what they did was organize or to support through the school administrations student branches, they call it, where students could join APHA at a student rate. Mm. And then as undergraduates or as students, you could get involved in certain professional projects. We brought in speakers, or you'd do professional activities. It was a way to kind of enhance your education and to draw you into the main flow of the profession, particularly the professional aspects, try to develop some sort of feeling of belonging and participation.
You also were a member of Phi Eta Sigma.
Well, Phi Eta Sigma was just a strictly honor society. And it was a freshman honor society. If your grade point average was high enough, then you automatically were admitted to Phi Eta Sigma.
What about Rho Chi? That's a
Rho Chi is an honorary professional fraternity or society for pharmacy. And I was a good enough student to be invited to join Rho Chi. Again, it's primarily honorary. Some activities. Over the years, the Rho Chi Society here at Wisconsin had sponsored a major lectureship, professional lectureship, bringing in the speakers, nationally recognized speakers, to the campus. That was their primary activity.
The final one here is Kappa Psi.
Kappa Psi was strictly a professional fraternal society. Mm-hmm. It was for fellowship with other pharmacy students. During the war, there was a Kappa Psi chapter here at Madison, but during the war it went, kind of into hibernation. There just weren't male students around enough to keep a fraternity going. So it was my class, or that time, that the Kappa Psi was reactivated. And I was one of the people that was involved in getting the chapter restarted again. But at the time, there was no house. We didn't have anything like that. It was strictly a matter of forming an organization, getting it going.
Now, your book also listed you as a cheerleader. Could you talk a little bit about your activities there?
Well, I was a cheerleader for my freshman year, 1943-44. I had been a cheerleader through 4 years of high school, mostly, I guess, as a mascot, because I was pretty small in high school. I don't think I was 5 feet tall when I started high school. But I got my feet wet. I kind of enjoyed that. I'm kind of a sports nut anyhow. And I got up here, and again, at that time, cheerleading was a male-only activity.
Yes, right.
There were no women were cheerleaders. And so that meant that cheerleading was at an ebb. There just wasn't much choice. It happened that the guy in charge of cheerleading, a fellow by the name of Eddie Daub, was also a chem major, or a chemistry engineering major, and he lived at, or was active in Alpha Chi Sigma. And it was Eddie Daub that kind of twisted my arm to get me started as a cheerleader. So there were basically the two of us as cheerleaders for that football and basketball season.
Oh, really? So you were out on the football field at Camp Randall?
Oh, yeah.
The two of you leading the whole student section?
I might add, just as an aside, the football team wasn't very good that year. 1942, was an outstanding year for Wisconsin football, but then all of those guys got drafted or pulled in the Navy, and I think quite a few of them wound up over at Michigan the next
including
year.
Including Elroy Hirsch. Yeah, yes, right. I've heard about that.
And so the football team here was comprised of guys that they picked off of the V-12 and the V-5, programs that were going on in Madison. And it was so bad that Ed and I, just to kind of entertain ourselves, started playing slow motion football on the sidelines, pretending to tackle each other and run with the ball and things. And we got in trouble one time because the crowd was cheering And there was nothing going on in the field, or it was the wrong time to cheer for the field, and it turned out they were cheering us instead of the football team. And the powers that be let us know about that and said we shouldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, Wisconsin got very good at these extra activities for a long time. We finally have a football team that we can watch
yeah.
now, but maybe
yeah.
that's how our band got so good, too. You did go away for a couple of years. The war intervened. Could you talk a little bit about what you did? You were in the Army, correct?
Yes.
Could you talk about those war years, 46, I'm sorry.
It was 44 to 46.
Yeah, no, 44 to 46.
Well, As I said, I got drafted. I went into service in July of 1944, went to basic training in the infantry. I was at Camp Robinson in Arkansas. I applied for the Officer's Candidate School, OCS, at Fort Benning, Georgia, and was accepted. And so I, after completing basic training, that was probably mid to late March, the OCS class didn't start until after January 1st, so I was just kind of temporarily assigned in administration at Camp Robinson. But the thing I wanted to just mention as an aside was that was the fall of the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the guys that I was in basic training with got sent over, and within a few weeks after completing basic training, they were right in the middle of the Battle of the Bulge.
Those fresh troops that were dropped right into the middle of it. Yeah, that was
several lost their lives there.
I'm sure that was true. Yeah.
So I did go to OCS and got my commission as a second lieutenant in the infantry in May 22nd, 1945, which was just about the time the war ended. I was sent to Texas for a little while and then to California as a second lieutenant, and was preparing to ship out to the Pacific when they dropped the bombs in Japan, and then that war was over. So I went over to Japan, spent my time in Yokohama in the occupational forces.
Mm-hmm.
I went over in September of 45 and came back in September of 46. So that was pretty much my career. Instead of infantry, when I got over to Japan, I was transferred into a quartermaster trucking company.
Mm-hmm.
It was heavy trucks unloading ships in the Yokohama port. And what I knew about trucking was, here I was an 18-year-old second lieutenant. Well, I guess by then I was 19. But it was an interesting experience.
Did you have charge? Were you in charge of certain aspects of
the company? I was the executive officer of the company. Actually, at that time, the Army was segregated.
Hmm.
The enlisted troops in our company were black, and the officers were white. I don't know that makes much sense. But I wasn't involved in actually driving or anything like that. Mine was strictly an administrative responsibility.
Well,
I've
talked to some people who have gone up into administration in the university, and they said they got their first taste of it when they were in the Army in World War II,
mm-hmm.
often doing things like just like that,
and
found that they rather enjoyed it. did you have any feelings about it one way or another?
I guess, you know, now that you asked the question, I suppose in retrospect that may be the case. I didn't think of it that way at the time it was happening. You know, it was just,
you were just there.
That's what I was supposed to do. And so I did it. But I guess, you know, there's certainly some experience in that regard, taking it, you know, that I learned. I'd hate to try to put my finger on something right now, but, it was an exposure.
Yeah. For people listening, we have a little broken up career here. Let me just summarize the dates again. Dean Lemberger was an undergraduate in 43 and 44, went into the military from 44 to 46, and then returned to the university as an undergraduate from 46 to 48. In 1948, and for the next 4 years and through 52, you enrolled in graduate school here at the university. Could you talk about how that came about?
Well, as I say, the exposure to Alpha Chi Sigma and to the graduate students in 43, 44 really created in me the thought that there was more education that I could pursue and a different career. And I always kind of leaned toward teaching. I thought that would be a nice life to lead, and it has been.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I was just talking briefly about what it was like coming back after the war, so there were just a lot of guys like myself coming back who had started pharmacy school, and we were all on the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. From 46 to 48, it was kind of whatever courses were required that you had to complete to get your degree, you took them when they came. It's like getting on a merry-go-round. Mm-hmm. The concept of prerequisites was almost non-existent. I mean, if you could handle it, you could take it.
Yeah,
and nobody was looking to see whether you had the prerequisite course or not. Because everybody was interested in trying to finish up as quickly as they could. We were all a couple of years older.
That's right.
and really wanted to get on with our lives. But because we were older, I think that the student at that time, the returning GI student, was much more serious about his education and you know, really worked at it, knew what we were there for. So it worked. It really did. One thing about that, I guess I was going to say, is as a result, we didn't, the traditional class, you know, having classmates, there was no kind of class of 1948 except for the fact that we all graduated in 1948. We were in courses. I took some courses with guys who were a year ahead of me. I took courses with people who were a year behind me. And you never knew who was in what class. So
class
it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's
right.
Very interesting.
Yeah. But now you were asking about my decision to go on into graduate work. That was also aided by being collared by the faculty, by Dale Wooster, by Dean Ewell and Louis Bussey, who at the time were building the graduate program and were hand-selecting kind of students who had potential, that in their view, who had potential, and really inviting them to consider graduate education. So that, you know, the combination of seeing what it was like and then really being told, gee, you could do this, was very intriguing and certainly persuaded me that was something I wanted to do. From a family standpoint, my brother was a pharmacist, and he was back in practice with Dad, or when he got out of the service, he was back in practice with Dad. So the sense of family obligation to go back and work in the pharmacy and kind of take over really was also ameliorated, and so it was an easy decision. I suppose one hard part in retrospect, I was married in 1947, and we had three children before I finished graduate school, and were expecting our fourth. So things were, in that sense, were kind of pressed, but we managed.
Let's talk for a moment about that part of your life. We have talked about this before, I think about 8 or 9 years ago when I interviewed you for a program dealing with Badger Village. Tell me a little bit about your experience, your experiences at Badger Village. How did you find out about it? What was it like living out there?
Well, Badger Village, you know, at the time, because of the influx of returning veterans, housing in Madison was virtually non-existent. Mm-hmm. You had to almost be in line on the porch when someone moved out an apartment so you could move in. If you weren't right there, you know, you just didn't get it. I can remember, actually before we were married, just walking the streets around the university area looking for a place that we might be able to rent without success. But the university operated there were trailer courts on Camp Randall. There was another one out on University Avenue near where Hilldale is now. And then they had Badger Village, which was the housing for the old ammunition plant that was operative during the war. That's about 35 miles outside of town.
Near Baraboo, I think it's low.
It's between Sauk City and Baraboo.
Baraboo,
yeah.
Right.
Considered Baraboo, I guess.
Considered Baraboo, yeah.
Yeah. But we lived, there were two sections to Badger. There was North Badger and South Badger. The South Badger apartments were single, you know, one-story, well, they're all one-story units, but they were kind of separate units, where the North Badger apartments were in buildings that had 24 two-bedroom apartments per building, which is where we lived. You had a kitchen and a little sitting area with a hide-a-bed, and then a small bedroom. The bathrooms and showers and laundry area was all down the hall. That was communal. You didn't have your own bathroom. But it was, in many respects, it was a very pleasant lifestyle. Nobody had anything. So, you know, you didn't put on any airs, or there was no one-upmanship kind of thing. You were all in the same boat, most of us returning veterans, many with small children. And so the camaraderie within the building and across buildings was great. We, you know, formed friendships that have lasted for a lifetime in our staying at.
Your rent was $30 a month, and that included
heat? That heat, light, you know, all utilities. It was just for $30 a month, you had all of it.
That's just great.
So that lasted. We were there till 1950, and then by that time, it was difficult to, in a sense, of a graduate student, because we rode buses in the morning and ride a bus again back at night. But when my graduate education got beyond the coursework, the heavy coursework load, and started into the research phase, then it became more difficult because of that travel distance and the lack of time around the campus. So we did have to move into Madison. I think it was 1950. We found a house to rent, and then I could spend more time in the research laboratories and finish my PhD dissertation.
I've heard residents say that it was they would not trade that experience for anything, but they'd never want to do it again.
I think that's very apt. I sometimes wonder how we did do it, especially those cold winter mornings riding those buses and so on. But
yeah, the bus stories are legendary as well, where they had those two little heaters and you had to get to the right seat with the heaters. And there was that. Wasn't there a hill that you had to climb every day?
Springfield Hill. Yeah.
And many veteran wondered if the bus was going to make it up there on that particular day.
And on the slippery days. Well, when it really got bad, then we took the alternate route, which was out 14 through Grosse Plaines and then cut over to Sauk City on 78, I think, is the road. But that avoided Springfield Hill, because that could be pretty treacherous if it got slippery. Yeah.
Okay, back to graduate school. Let's talk a little bit about the School of Pharmacy. How was it set up at that point? You said they were beginning to build a graduate program.
Well, it was actually during my time. Let's go back. World War II probably had a great impact on what happened in pharmacy and pharmaceutical education because of the development of penicillin. That was such a widely useful drug, and yet so terribly unstable, that great efforts were made to put it into dosage forms, ways that it could be used, that it was very quickly eliminated by the body, so it had to be injected like every 4 hours, 4 to 6 hours, which was not a good therapy. So there was, you know, massive effort in industry to find ways of formulating penicillin so it would have longer lasting. In fact, it formed a complex with procaine, and procaine penicillin became very popular because in that insoluble complex, the penicillin was released slowly. What I'm getting at is it really awakened within the pharmacy research community the recognition that there was a lot to be done in terms of understanding the chemistry, understanding the physical properties of dosage forms, and understanding the properties of the systems in which we these things were placed. And I think Wisconsin made and Dean Ewell, absolutely marvelous decision in bringing a physical chemist, Takeru Higuchi, into the School of Pharmacy faculty. I think that was probably the first time in the country that a non-pharmacy person was brought to full membership on a pharmacy faculty. And what Dr. Higuchi brought was this great knowledge of physical chemistry and mathematics, and an intense focus and great dedication to advancing our understanding of pharmaceutical systems. And so it was in that time period that pharmacy really move from being something that was taught by rote, mm-hmm. where when you made emulsions, you mixed this, you know, these things, and 4-2-1 mixture, and you did it this way, and almost to the point of whether you rotated the pestle in the mortar clockwise mm-hmm. or counterclockwise, mm-hmm. And it, you know, because it worked. And really, we began understanding the nature of film formation, the nature of surface tension, and its effect on these kinds of systems. At any rate, this stimulated a great interest in graduate education, and Wisconsin was in the forefront of that movement, the real science movement, and the recognition of what we called at that time physical pharmacy, the importance of that in understanding pharmaceutical systems really got worked into the curriculum for the education of pharmacists, so that they would understand the kinds of systems that drugs were put in. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of a paradox there, because the intent of education was to educate this pharmacy graduate to knowledge about these systems, and also because of the increased complexity, the increased activity, the drugs really became more active compounds than we had, you know, we had aspirin and we had, you know, things that you could take a lot of and it wouldn't really make a great deal of difference. But then we were developing, now we're coming along products where the therapeutic index, we call it, the ratio between the effective dose and the toxic dose mm-hmm. was getting very, yes. very small. Yeah. And so it became very important for pharmacists to understand that. They had to know how things were used. They had to know pharmacology along with the other sciences. And the paradox was that at the time, the pharmacist, by his code of ethics, was not permitted to speak to the patient about what kind of effect the drug would have. The theory being that that was the doctor's, the physician's, the prescriber's mm-hmm. territory, and the fact that that drugs could have multiple uses, and so the pharmacist, if he said, well, this is used for so-and-so, you know, a particular condition, might be wrong, and that would get the patient all confused. So the paradox was that we were educating these young people with all of this information, and yet there was no legitimate way, in a sense, that they could use it in terms of helping the patients that they served. Our rationale was that the more they understood that, the more careful they would be in handling it themselves. There'd be less likelihood that they would be careless and make an error in dispensing if they really understood how significant the products that they were handling really were and what the potential dangers were. So, but that was in the late 40s. That probably was.
So we have a whole new game developing in the field of pharmacy in a lot of ways.
Oh, that's right.
Did the university bring in any other people besides Higuchi to?
The additions at that time that I recall, the faculty additions, were Dale Worcester was a young man. He just finished his PhD, and actually there was a revolutionary text was written by a combination of authors, but it included Worcester, Higuchi, and Bussi. Mm. And the three chapters that they wrote, Higuchi wrote the chapter on solubility, which was a real eye-opener in the sense of relating chemical structure to solubility that you could expect compounds to display, drugs and other compounds. Dale Worcester wrote the chapter on pharmaceutical dispensing and introduced concepts with regard to solubility, with regard to pH and acid-base reactions and that sort of thing, which influenced incompatibilities, that is, the drugs that couldn't be mixed in preparations and or how you could get around that problem. And Bussi and a couple of his students wrote a chapter on colloids, emulsions, and suspensions, which really outlined the importance of the surface active agent and film forming and forming an interface, protecting the interface between oil and water, between the solid and water, in order to how you produce systems like that and how you could stabilize systems of that nature. This was the first time that there really was that kind of light mm-hmm. cast on what was going on in pharmacy when compounding, or in industry, in the laboratories when they were formulating new products. Up until that time, it was largely empirical. Was in industry, for instance, the people who were doing formulation work were just seat of the pants type. You know, they had made tablets this way for a long time, and if that didn't work, then let's try something else. But there was no particular scientific reasoning. There was kind of seat of the pants and experiential reasoning, but not the scientific reasoning. And
so it was almost like a guild where things were passed from one.
That's
generation
right,
to the next.
And greatly, this information was greatly protected. The people in industry, were prohibited from talking to their colleagues, in a sense,
really?
For fear that some piece of information might escape as proprietary information. and people in industry, because their jobs were at risk, didn't want to share what they had learned particularly.
So it was a secret guild.
It was, in many respects. And it was the... largely the graduate students that were being produced here at Wisconsin in the late 40s and early 50s that a high percentage of them went into the pharmaceutical industry and really revolutionized the way pharmaceutical research was conducted in industry.
Is this something that Ewell and some of those earlier people had in mind when they were recruiting you people? Did they know that the doors needed to be open to a certain extent?
Yes, I think so. I think, I can't speak from personal first-hand knowledge because I wasn't really here, but the first couple of hires that Ewell made as director of the pharmacy program were Lloyd Parks and Louis Bussey. And they were both scientifically oriented, and I think that they recognized that there was potential that was untapped, that really they kind of knew their shortcomings and knew what kind of people would have the scientific knowledge to flush that out. And another fellow who later was on the faculty for a while, who was instrumental in that, was Joseph Swientoski, because Joe and Tak Higuchi were roommates as graduate students. Tak in physical chemistry, and Joe was a graduate student in pharmacy. And I think that Joe and Tak Higuchi spent a lot of time talking about pharmacy and pharmaceutical research as graduate students. And it was, I think Joe probably had something to do with bringing attention to what Tak had as background to the attention of Ewell and Bussey and Parks. So
it was Ewell's vision, in a sense.
As a matter of fact, I think that probably the greatest attribute that Ewell had was the ability and the willingness, to look forward and to bring high quality people on board, and then the smartness to step aside and let them do their thing.
And the courage, too. Yeah. It takes a certain amount of courage to just say, okay, we're turning over the keys at this point.
As a result, I think in many respects, Ewell didn't get the credit he really deserved because he was really in the background. I mean, he did not step forward and ever, thump his chest and say, look at what I've done here at Wisconsin. He was a very unassuming person. And unless you were, really close to that, very easy to overlook.
Were other schools in the Big Ten, for example, nationally, were they looking toward Wisconsin at this point, do you know, because of the kinds of things that were going on?
Yeah, there were actually through the 30s and 40s, there were basically two schools with recognized graduate programs. I think Wisconsin, since its inception, it had been a research-intensive school, right? The first director and right on through, they were high research focus. And that reputation was national, no question about it. The other school that had a fairly substantial graduate program was Purdue University. The philosophy at Purdue was more practice-oriented, very practical type of approach to graduate education. I don't want to downplay, but in my judgment, science wasn't as emphasized as experience and practice and norms of practice. It was a little more like a training program, in my judgment, than an educational program. And the Purdue graduates, did find careers in industry as well. So, but those were the two choices, in a sense, of graduate education at the time. I think that graduates of Wisconsin had a lot to do with expanding graduate programs nationally as well. People from Wisconsin went to Michigan. Michigan has an excellent graduate program now. California, we had people go out to California in the late 40s, early 50s, and had a lot to do with the quality of their graduate education. Later, people went to Kansas. Certainly in the late 40s, early 50s, Wisconsin, that was the focal point of graduate education and the evolution of physical pharmacy and physical sciences as part of the research armamentarium.
Now you were studying under Dale Worcester, you pronounce it.
Dale Worcester was my major professor. He was also a role model for me. He was an excellent teacher. When I was an undergrad, the capstone course in pharmacy was the pharmacy dispensing course, because that's what the pharmacist did.
Mm-hmm.
And Dale was epitomized to me what a professional pharmacist ought to be. He was very knowledgeable. He was science-based. I mean, there was just logic and thinking and so on in what he taught us. He was an excellent teacher, well organized, easy to follow, stimulating, and he was kind of Mr. Pharmacy in the state of Wisconsin because he had an interest in the graduates, he had an interest in practitioners, and spent time, working with them, the early days of extension work. He was my model. And I was easy, to decide to work with Dale as my mentor and major professor. I suppose, oddly though, my dissertation project, which had to do with solids, it was the formation of microparticles of steroids by a sublimation, rapid freezing sublimation technique, was kind of out of Dale's direct personal research interest. I'm trying to think how I got into it. I think I got into it because of Louis Bussy primarily suggesting that was something that was could be looked at. Again, at the time, you see, understanding the nature of the physical properties of solids was important, and nature of amorphous solid. Well, trying to put solids into small particle size so they could be suspended, and particularly this was about the time that cortisone was discovered, and it was a highly insoluble compound and was used largely in suspensions. And the thought that would there be a way of producing good suspensions of steroids. And this was a technique to be considered. But what I'm getting at is that the knowledge and the science behind that project was more in Dr. Higuchi's area than in Dr. Worcester's area. So I spent probably as much time talking research with Dr. Higuchi as I did with Dr. Worcester, almost like a joint
great
major professorship.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. That was the dissertation work that I did, and the selection of my major professor.
Now, Dr. Higuchi, while we're on him, he did not remain at UW. Did he leave at some point?
He left in about, it was the mid-60s, probably about 1965, 66.
Okay.
It was after 65, but about 66, he went to Kansas. I can, we can maybe touch on that a little bit later on.
Okay. Did you work as a graduate assistant during your years?
Well, I was a graduate assistant, and I taught graduate assistants at that time, you know, assisted in the laboratories. We really supervised students in laboratory. If there was a quiz session associated with the laboratory, we would kind of moderate that and teach that. So it was a way to get my feet wet in teaching, and I found that I did enjoy that a great deal. My primary teaching responsibilities as a graduate assistant were in the dispensing pharmacy course, mm-hmm. which was very fulfilling as well. But I found that I enjoyed working with students and teaching. It was kind of fun when you could see someone grasp a concept, really understand something, and you had a part in helping that person reach that point. It was very fulfilling, very satisfying.
Well, we'll talk about your teaching later on when you were a professor, because you became noted as an excellent teacher. You said that a lot of the people who were at Wisconsin at the time as graduate students went off into other areas, went to other campuses, went into industry. Yeah. Are there any particular people that you would like to mention as any of your classmates who made their mark in the field, either in at the university level or in industry?
Well, one classmate that I had who made a mark in the field was Robert Hamill. He was a professor here at the University of Wisconsin. We were classmates as undergrads. Bob's interest was pharmacy administration, and he carved out a very, very important career in pharmaceutical education and in that field.
And so also played a little bit of a role in you coming
something to do with that.
Another thing happened while you were a student, and that's the pharmacy department in 1950 broke off from LNS and became the School of Pharmacy. Was that something that, as a graduate student, you were aware of as having any significance or impact, or is it something that just sort of went past you?
As students, that really didn't have any great effect on us, no direct effect. I mean, the faculty was growing and evolving, and the courses were being, the content was being modified as we went. I think the primary effect was in the administration of the school, because it now became a separate entity. Ewell became a dean. Mm-hmm. That meant that he had direct access to, at that time, was president of the university. And so it eliminated a layer. Up until that time, it was a program in the College of Letters and Science. That also meant that, from a faculty standpoint, I'm presuming this a little bit, but from a faculty standpoint, a greater sense of control over their curriculum.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because prior to that, if there were any major curriculum changes, they would have to be submitted to the Letters and Science faculty for their approval as part of that college. Now, as a separate administrative organization, if the Faculty of Pharmacy decided that a change in requirements was warranted or authorized or content, it was up to them, and then it was submitted to whatever directly into the university channels of approval, mm-hmm. whatever existed at the time. It also, I think, meant probably greater flexibility in the sense of hiring, or more independence, more autonomy in the sense of hiring. I don't know how it worked exactly,
mm-hmm.
but it would seem to me that being part of Letters and Science, that appointment of people to the pharmacy faculty would have to be approved through that faculty.
Right. Yeah, that would make sense.
And that dean, whereas a school now, the faculty and the dean of the pharmacy school would have control, except for divisional committees or whatever. That I don't know what the campus structure was at the time. I do know that that at that time, I think operationally, there was a lot more authority vested in the administration than there is now. I think faculty governance was a concept that really came into being later on, mm-hmm. in the 60s mm-hmm. and 70s, perhaps.
Well, you had these long-term people like Ewell, for example, who was there for for a long time. He was dean for a long time, but he had been director before that.
Yes.
So, and that was not uncommon in a lot of schools and colleges on campus. Plus, it seems to me like 1950 would have been just about the right time, from what you're saying, for pharmacy to sort of take off on their own and start striking a new path.
It was. It's a unique time. It's a time that you know, one couldn't reproduce today any longer. The good thing is that Wisconsin and the faculty at that time capitalized on that opportunity. Mm-hmm.
It would be interesting to really do research on that whole move breakaway from LNS, because a lot of other schools went through that. The education went through that, business went through that, and there always seemed to be some real compelling reasons for doing so.
I'm sure that there may have been downside to it. I've thought about this. I think the whole budget of the School of Pharmacy at that time was probably substantially less than $100,000, and the money for supplies and equipment was limited. There was no money for major pieces of research equipment. There was no travel money in the budget for getting to meetings and things. That it was bearable. But that was normal. I don't think the school was probably any different than any other school on the campus at the time. It was faculty teaching loads were heavy. By today's standards,
yes.
Teaching loads were heavy.
They were enormous.
On the other hand, I suppose that since research was in relative infancy, that the whole campus, the whole research environment just exploded in the 1950s primarily because of NIH funding.
Right. Federal funds.
And that greatly influenced the culture of the campus, I think. So in perspective, while we all had research programs, at the same time we were expected to do more teaching. So the expectation on research was different. I think, in my judgment, while research was important and discovery of new knowledge was important, it was also important because it was a training ground for young people and because it was a way for faculty to demonstrate their creativity and that their minds were open, that they would stay abreast of their field through a career of teaching. Mm-hmm. What you didn't want was a faculty that in 1970 was teaching what they were teaching in 1950.
Right.
And I think that was an important component of why we were doing research. As research funding expanded and the costs of research expanded and the need for extramural funding expanded, I think that the research became much more demanding. And as a result, because of those pressures, faculty just found it necessary, really, to reduce the amount of time they spend on teaching.
So the means to the end, in some instances, would become the end itself over time.
Well,
not entirely.
That's
unfair. But there was a shift in focus. Let me say.
Yeah, the point I want to make is that the culture of the university changed because of what was going on around us.
Right.
Not because there was weakening of the commitment to what the university was about. It's just that what the university was about began to change.
Right. Also, for people listening, we talk about the School of Pharmacy, and we think today, gosh, how many members are there on it? But I'm looking at the roster from announcement of courses from the 4850 catalog, and you have as professors Parks, Ewell, and Erdang.
Mm-hmm.
And then Associate Professor Bussey, singular, Associate Professor Bussey, yeah. And assistant professors Colby, Higuchi, and then instructor Worcester. So we're talking about a faculty here of 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people. And obviously they would work with people from other departments and whatnot. But that was pharmacy.
That's right.
At that point in time. So let's just kind of get that on the record so people can see that we're not talking about a huge, huge number of people at this point in time. You did get your PhD, and you took a job that was in August of 52. And you accepted a job as a senior chemist doing pharmaceutical R&D at Merck & Company. Right. How did that come about? Why did you take that job? And how did your year or two there go?
Well,
one year.
I can explain that, too. The reason I've mentioned that my career interest was teaching, but I felt that to go directly from a PhD into teaching would be my experience would be limited. And I felt that, particularly given the fact that industry was changing so dramatically at the time, that 2 or 3 years of experience of research in the industry would give me a perspective that would be very helpful, both in teaching and research, mm-hmm. if I went back to a university, went back to a teaching career. So it was my intent when I went with Merck to spend 2 to 3 years doing that, and then look for a teaching post someplace. How I got to Merck, I guess, well, Merck had been primarily a chemical house. Their getting involved in pharmaceuticals was relatively recent at that time, and I was, you know, they were big in antibiotic production. And they were the discoverers or the developers of cortisone, synthetic cortisone. And that, because those were the major products at the time, really forced Merck into an expansion mode in terms of pharmaceutical research.
So that was one of the reasons we were advised by the faculty to look for a...
Right. Actually, you know, the people I looked to were Wooster, Higuchi and Bussi, and they were unanimous in suggesting that Merck would be a good place for me. So I went out and interviewed and was interested, was offered a position. The position that was at that time very lucrative. It was, I think my base salary was $6,000 a year, and there was a cost of living quarterly bonus that amounted to about $400 a year. And that was a substantial offer for the time.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they didn't pay moving expenses at the time, so I had to borrow money to move out there, which I was still paying a year later. But to continue my story, it was at that time, and probably because of the pressure on Merck that I'm talking about to develop pharmaceutical research quickly, that Merck actually merged with another pharmaceutical company, an old-line pharmaceutical company called Sharp & Dohme. Sharp & Dohme was located in Philadelphia, and it became clear that merger took place the year I was at Merck, and it became clear that the pharmaceutical research activities were going to be transferred to Philadelphia, to the Sharp & Dohme laboratories, where there was much more experience and a larger staff. By that time, I wanted to go into teaching. I didn't really want to subject my family to moving once to New Jersey, and a year later moving to Philadelphia, and then a year later moving someplace else. And I did hear that Joe Swintowski had left Wisconsin, or was leaving Wisconsin, to take a position with Smith, Kline, and French in industry. And so I contacted Dean Yule and asked if there was an opening. This all happened pretty fast, actually, probably between June and August of that year.
Yeah.
Well, you know, at the time,
yeah.
We didn't have search committees.
Right,
and
right. Now it just seems like you absolutely couldn't do that.
and they didn't have travel money to go and interview either. It turned out that Louis Bussi was going to be in Philadelphia on some other business with the industry. And my being in New Jersey, I took a day off and went down to Philadelphia and met with Dr. Bussi in a hotel room, and we talked about the position and my interests, and I guess he was sizing me up. And then he went back to Madison, and I did. I got the offer to come back to Wisconsin and take Dr. Swintowski's position. The teaching at the time was in pharmacognosy, which was not my discipline at all. But the thought was that, in a matter of a short time, I would be shifted into the pharmaceutics group, and that would be more comfortable for me. And as far as research was concerned, that could be, it didn't have to be in pharmacognosy. It could
tell,
be in
tell me, and the layperson listening, pharmacognosy, that's not something we're familiar with today. What was that?
Well, pharmacognosy was the science of natural products, drugs from animals, plants. So things like alkaloids and glycosides and those kinds of chemical compounds that you find in nature. Mm-hmm. And it was largely, at that time, largely a botanical orientation, being able to identify the plant species, knowing its botanical name and what it contained and that sort of thing. given my background in pharmacy and pharmacology, I changed the focus of the course from a botanical, taxonomical approach to a pharmacological approach. So I started talking about these natural products more from the standpoint of what conditions or what they did in the body, what their pharmacological action was, rather than what their botanical names were and what they looked like and how to identify the leaves or the roots or whatever. Because, you know, that was never a strong suit for me. In fact, I think the only course I ever got a C in college was in pharmacognosy.
And here you come as the new the new kid.
But
on the
it, again, it reflected the rapid change of the time. See, the pharmacist, they weren't handling crude drugs anymore. You didn't have boxes with drugs and leaves and so on that you tried to grind up and put in capsules. We were moving toward the synthetic chemical and pharmacologically active entities rather than these mixtures. So that change, and the change obviously was well received by the students, and it was I enjoyed teaching that, and the students were very responsive to it.
Now, an interesting thing you said, that you went into industry, you were encouraged by Ewell and others to go into industry for a little bit and then come back. And when you came back, Swintoski was moving into industry. Was this something that had been done frequently in the past, or was this kind of a sign of the times, too, that there was more switching back and forth?
I don't know that one could talk about it as a trend or anything. I think it was just the individuals. I think that I can only surmise that what Swintoski's motivation was. Joe was interested. He was one of the early researchers in what we call biological half-life, and that was measuring, taking physical chemical theory, mathematical theory, and applying it to how long drugs stayed in the bloodstream when they were administered. And by knowing how long they stayed there, you could get an idea of how long they were going to be effective. Mm-hmm. And that, in turn, would influence your dosing schedule, right, whether you had to take it every 4 hours, every 6 hours, every 8 hours, or whatever. Joe was early on in that concept, and I think there was a unique opportunity at SmithKline French to begin to apply that concept to dosage form development. Mm-hmm. And I think that may have been, you know, his primary attraction from a career standpoint. I'm sure that from a financial standpoint, it was probably also very attractive for Joe, because he was had a reputation as a researcher, and I'm sure they did all they could to entice him to take that post.
Now, he wasn't here for very long, was he?
Well, he was here as a graduate student for quite some time, and he taught, in fact, as a graduate student, he taught organic chemistry. I had him as an organic chemistry teacher for my second semester of organic chemistry after I came back from the service. But Joe was not in the service. Joe was 4F, I think. Mm. And so he was here through the war period. Mm-hmm. And then he was his position on the faculty probably 2-3 years, perhaps, that he was on the faculty.
When you came back to teach, did you intend to stay at Madison? Was that... At that point, did you have a clear idea of what you wanted to do?
It was a fulfillment of kind of a dream. I really, Wisconsin being what it was to me, the opportunity to be here was really great. And, yeah, I had thought that I would spend the rest of my career at Wisconsin. One other thing I should say, going back to my industrial experience, that 1 year that I had, while useful to me, I don't think ever was quite enough, in retrospect. Mm-hmm. It would have been worked out for me better had I been able to stay in industry for 2 or 3 years.
Right.
But the opportunity was here, and so I cut that short. And, I certainly had a very satisfying career. But
you'd still had a feel, at least, for what it was like to be in that other...
We had a course in manufacturing pharmacy at the time here. We had a manufacturing laboratory, made tablets and emulsions and suspensions and ointments, and the products that we made were used in the state hospitals, Northern Wisconsin Colony, Southern Colony,
for the
children,
that's
so it was a course that offered students some realism, because what they were making was actually used, was mm-hmm. consumed. And we supported the laboratory because there would be fund transfers, you know, between the institutions, even as all state institutions, that brought money back to pay for the raw materials, so in turn we could continue to manufacture. So in that sense, my industrial experience was useful.
Now, you were at the University of Wisconsin on the faculty from 1953 to 1969?
Yes.
Something like that. So that's a long period of time. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the School of Pharmacy during that time and then focus in on your particular career within that context. I sent you an attachment of the faculty of the school in 1954-56, so we can start to see that there are more people on it, and it, of course, grew considerably during your years here. Let's talk a little bit about that new faculty, or about the faculty at that point, and the way it grew, and some of the people who were involved in it. You said that Taguchi was a good researcher, and he had stayed here till 1965.
It was after 65. I'm not sure. 66 or 67 that he left.
Okay, let's talk about how that faculty evolved during the time you were here. Who were some of the major hires, the key people who came in and helped the school?
Well, I've already mentioned the early additions of Dr. Higuchi and Dr. Worcester. There was an evolution in pharmacy education at the time. That if I can go into that now,
then maybe tack on how
the faculty expanded. There was a study, a national study of pharmacy conducted in the late 40s, that because of the evolution that was going on, that came out actually with a recommendation that pharmacy should be expanded to a 6-year academic program and in a Doctor of Pharmacy degree. That was a very controversial report that came out, as they say, around 1948-49, something like that. And it occupied the discussion halls of pharmacy education, American Association of Colleges of Pharmacy, for some time, with some strong feeling. Obviously, a great concern about moving, you know, adding 2 years to the program mm-hmm. at that time, and wondering, given the role of the pharmacist, you know, what's going on. One of the great stimulations for that was the recognition of the need for pharmacy students to have more education in what was at that time called pharmacy administration. Mm-hmm. The upshot was that there was a compromise reached of going to 5 years of a program instead of 6, and part of the requirement was the addition then of a substantial amount of coursework in pharmacy administration, which is really the business marketing aspects of pharmacy practice. Remember at the time that pharmacy was kind of a cross between a merchant role mm-hmm, and a professional mm-hmm. role. Mm-hmm. And the feeling that as the profession was evolving, that pharmacists had to be more astute in terms of the environment in which they practiced if they were going to maintain a quality of practice. They had to be able to compete market-wise and so on, and understand the dynamics of the marketplace to successfully fulfill that requirement. So given that expansion of the curriculum, the changes going on in the science, plus the addition of pharmacy administration, there were some additions here. One addition was Dr. William Apple. He actually was a graduate student here at the same time I was. His discipline was pharmacy administration. And at that time, obviously, pharmacy had no PhD program in that discipline. So Bill Apple was actually a student of Howard Westing in the School of Business. Mm-hmm. And he took business courses and worked on a research dissertation that was applicable to pharmacy and got his degree, his PhD, mm-hmm. through the School of Business. And Bill then was added to the faculty as a first edition in the in pharmacy administration, and also with then the beginning to recognize the importance of extension and continuing education. Bill was an important addition. We added Glenn Sonnedecker. Erdang, who was a historian of international repute, had retired, and was emeritus, and Wisconsin did have a strong affiliation with and commitment to the history of pharmacy mm-hmm. as part of our cultural heritage, pharmacy's cultural heritage. And so there was a position in history of pharmacy, and Len Sonnendecker was brought in on that. And I'll talk about what these people became later. Another important addition was in the field of chemistry, a fellow by the name of Ed Smissman, who was brought on board. His background was a PhD in chemistry, but again, another person with a very strong commitment to pharmacy and pharmaceutical education. I know, talking to my former graduate students, that they were saying that when Ed came, because he didn't know pharmacy, what he would do when he was organizing what he wanted to teach, he would go to the pharmacy graduate students and ask them, you know, is this relevant? Is this something that I should be teaching? And getting advice from students who had been through the program, which I think, you know, illustrates the kind of commitment that the man made to trying to be an effective force in pharmaceutical education. Now, you know, these people, when you Parks, who went on, he became dean at Ohio State University, and under his deanship, that became a first-class research mm-hmm. teaching institution, highly revered at Ohio State. In fact, they named the pharmacy building after him.
Oh, really?
After
oh,
he retired. Yeah. Also, a great leader in professional pharmacy, president of the APHA at one time, Remington medalist. Tak Higuchi, we've talked about mm-hmm. Tak and his contributions, and we probably will talk more as we continue to review what happened here in Wisconsin. But he, Bussey and his contributions in research, I mean, these people won research prizes, mm-hmm. the major prizes in pharmacy. Dale Worcester, not only a great researcher, but later an inventor of a revolutionary coating technique that revolutionized completely the nature, the way tablets are coated in the pharmaceutical industry. Glenn Sonnendecker, historian, internationally acclaimed historian, a Remington medalist. Remington medal is the highest award that the profession of pharmacy gives to anyone for careers. Contributions, and I might say Apple and Barks and Sonnendecker and Higuchi, these were all Remington medalists at one time or another. Ed Smissman was highly recognized. He went to Kansas first, but in his field he was well recognized. All I'm saying is that here we have a faculty of 10 or 12 people, and you have, you know, that kind of talent.
Yeah.
In that small
That's
group,
amazing,
it's
right.
really, yeah, yeah. You can't do it again, so
yeah.
to speak.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
How fortunate for you to come in as a youngster and to, well, you were a little older than the average beginning
yeah.
person because of the war, but you were still pretty young at that point.
I
have these people surrounding
yes.
you on a daily basis. That's
I was very fortunate, yes, and very fortunate by many, you know, of the students at the time to be considered part of that group.
I want to talk a little bit more about a different group that's often ignored. Staff often play a very crucial mm-hmm. role in the development of a school or college. Did you have any librarians or secretaries or people like that who just sort of stand out in your mind as being important contributors to the school?
Well, contributors in the sense of kind of, how to put this, you know, the woodwork,
right,
the important
right.
you know, stuff, and yet so easily overlooked.
Well, sort of the ambience, too. That
yeah,
create
right.
to
yeah.
They make you feel the way you feel sometimes when you walk mm-hmm. into the building, the people
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, I think we, and in general, the staff shared the same kind of enthusiasm for what we were
mm-hmm.
doing
mm-hmm.
as the faculty. The longtime secretary of the department, Lois Lane, was...
Lois Lane?
Yes, yeah. yeah. An important factor, and a kind of, you know, a unique kind of character too, in a sense that if she would do anything for you if you struck her right, if you happened to hit her on a bad day, you just kind of avoided the office. But so much a part of
yes.
the family, and librarians, you mentioned, yes, we had a small pharmacy library, and any time that, you know, they would lean over backwards to try to be helpful, to try to find things for you, if it was in a different library, to track it down and get it. You know, things like that that you just kind of tend to overlook too easily.
Right.
And they're very important.
Well, looking back at my own experience again, I can remember our secretary, and she played mother to a lot of our graduate students, and we needed some serious mothering at times.
Yeah.
And there's just no way of measuring the value of that, except to know that they're there and they're, you know,
that's right.
For
this,
you.
The storeroom personnel were, you know, important in
helping. Your field especially.
Yeah, helping you find, track down rare chemicals that you might need for research, or, you know, it's Norm Jurdy was probably the principal one there, and he was very helpful.
Well, I like those people's names mentioned because they're oftentimes just overlooked in histories and reflections. Let's talk just a little bit more about Dean Ewell. Again, he was dean from 50 until 68. You've mentioned him on several occasions. Glenn Sonnendecker, in his book, George Zografi writes in Sonnendecker's book that between 50 and 68, a more modern curriculum was developed, graduate programs grew in size and impact, extension services in pharmacy became a major educational program, and an innovative internship program was developed. We're going to talk pretty much about extension later on because you became heavily involved in that. But is there anything in that list that you would like to comment on or add to regarding Dean Ewell's absolutely crucial input into the development of the school?
Well, as I said before, I think that the major contribution he made as an administrator was to really allow the people, this quality staff, to you know, its reign, its ability to pursue valid objectives.
It more or less turned them loose in a sense.
Yeah,
and allowed them to
and
be
step
what
aside.
They,
and
yeah.
You know, I think to some extent, I can't think of any examples, but to some extent, he must certainly have overseen that, you know, we didn't go off you know, in some cockeyed direction, but then, you know, given the nature of the people, that wasn't very likely either. So he was very effective in that regard. I would say that I think the if there was a deficiency, it showed up a little bit later in his deanship. He was a very close personal friend of Conrad Elvium, who was president of the university. And Dr. Elvium died very suddenly of a heart attack
in
his office.
Right.
And Professor Harrington, who was a major figure on the campus, and as I recall, he was on his way to Hawaii to be president of the University of Hawaii, and he was recalled to become president of the University of Wisconsin. And I I think that between the loss of this close personal friend and then the different administrative style of Harrington, that Dean Ewell felt somewhat uncomfortable and really didn't represent the School of Pharmacy at the Hill perhaps as vigorously as he might have, in that this was probably from, you know, about 1960 on. And that's not unusual either. I suppose, you know, most of us, you know, begin to wind down, I think,
after
a while.
Yes, right.
In fact, there was just, you know, given the example of Dean Ewell and my great respect for what he accomplished at the University of Wisconsin, my great respect for him as an individual, and yet seeing him reviewed by others too much for the last 5 years of his deanship,
right.
You know, kind of persuaded me that as far as I was concerned, about 10 years would be the maximum lifetime
yeah.
in a single administrative position, because in 10 years you've either pretty much accomplished what you set out to do, or what you haven't accomplished you've decided is not possible to do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, find something else to do. Which is, you know, it turns out that that's pretty much what happened in my career. So it's easy for me to say at this stage.
But it was
well, I spent 11 years at the University of Illinois mm-hmm. as a dean before I came back here as dean. And, you know, in all candor, I was at the point at Illinois where I felt I really had to find another position, because I had reached that point. We had done a lot.
Yeah.
And there were things there that I knew should be changed, but I felt this faculty isn't going to change. And maybe under my leadership they wouldn't have. But the guy who replaced me changed some of those things.
I see. Yes. Because he didn't know they couldn't
yeah,
be replaced.
That's right. You know, so in that sense, it proved out. I think that coming here and having a fresh start and being the new guy on the block,
yeah.
new administrator, you can get things done that maybe people here thought
yeah.
couldn't or shouldn't
yeah.
be done.
Yeah, I understand completely. We talked about Louis Bussey in some other context, but he was associate dean from 50 until 68, a long period of time, right along with Dean Ewell. Any comments on him as an administrator?
Well, Bussey was the kind of the go-to guy on a day-to-day basis that we all worked with. If there were things we needed or questions we had, it was kind of go in and see Louis. It was good and it was bad. At Dean's, you know, Ewell's administrative style, there was no table of organization per se. It was, you know, if you were drawing a table of organization, you'd have one box at the top of the school and it would say Ewell, and right underneath it would say Bussey.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was no delineation of what areas of responsibility were Louis and what was Dean Ewell. I mean, you just, everything kind of funneled through Louis, and then occasionally you'd want to go and see the dean, but by and large, day-to-day things were Louis, whether it's equipment or, you know, whatever. And in that role, he was very effective. He was a good, if he supported what you wanted, he was a good ombudsman for you. If he didn't support what you wanted, you never knew.
Mm-hmm.
You just didn't get it. But I felt, you know, as an aside, I felt that that was that organization or that working relationship, while I guess it was fine for Ewell and Bussey, they were comfortable with it, was not a very good one from Louis' standpoint. I felt that because he was in that same box, that there was a tendency to paint Louis with whatever deficiencies one might have ascribed to Ewell, that kind of lapped over on him as well.
Especially in those last years that
yeah,
talking about.
Yeah, I think I have particular in mind, and we'll talk about it later, but particularly in mind the replacement, you know,
mm-hmm.
the search for a replacement
right, we'll
for Dean Ewell.
We'll talk about that later.
And I, you know, again, for me, the lesson as an administrator was if I was going to have people associated in my administration, I wanted to be sure that they had areas of responsibility that were delineated very carefully for the faculty, that people would know, you know, if it's in this, if it's, you know, clinical education, you go see so-and-so, if it's research, you see so-and-so, you know, that there were certain areas that they would have, and they could then develop reputations or, you know, get their credibility by their ability to mm-hmm. effectively operate, and then not second-guess my people, you know, not reverse them, but certainly not publicly reverse them. If there was something I felt that could have been decided differently, I would try to persuade them that they really ought to mm-hmm. change their minds mm-hmm. rather than overrule
mm-hmm.
Something. So, you know, that, I guess, was a lesson I learned from that relationship. But, you know, in terms of how they operated, it was a very effective operation.
Was it essentially a two-person operation at that point in time? There weren't any other associate deans or assistant
deans?
That's
right. There weren't any. For a number of years, I served as the admissions officer for the School of Pharmacy, but it was without title. I wasn't labeled as a dean, but I handled. We didn't, you know, again, a small faculty like that, We didn't have admissions committees. In fact, well, after the war, I'm getting a kind of an aside, but I started, but after the war, there was this onslaught of students, and so there was a large enrollment in pharmacy. But then in the 50s, that kind of diminished again. Mm-hmm. And we were to the point where there was such a shortage of pharmacists that we were really scraping, you know, trying to get students into the School of Pharmacy.
Was it just that students lost interest in that? Were there other fields that they were taking?
I think it was a combination. It was recognized on the campus as a rigorous program of study.
Yeah.
The career as a pharmacist was, you know, it was changing, but it was, to the uninitiated, it was kind of not quite a professional career. Actually, up until the 50s, most of the people that came in, or the majority, I should mm-hmm. say most, the majority of students who came into pharmacy either were like me, who had relatives, father, mm-hmm. uncle, or who had worked in a drugstore as part of their high school earning capacity, or somehow had a nodding acquaintance with pharmacy mm-hmm. before they mm-hmm. picked pharmacy mm-hmm. as a career. It was not viewed, you know, publicly. We'd talk to high schools and career counseling and stuff, but there weren't an overwhelming number of kids who decided that they would like to be pharmacists.
Well, it's a pretty demanding curriculum.
It was rigorous. It was tough. So, you know, unless you really wanted it, it wasn't the thing you'd get into because it was a nice way to get a degree. And it would offer you a living. All I was saying is because of that, really.
So you were able to use your own discretion to determine.
Pretty much so. One thing I remember now, going back to the question when the school was formed as its own administrative unit. One of the things that was done at the time was to divide the curriculum into 1 year of pre-pharmacy and 3 years of pharmacy. And then there was an admission requirement from pre-pharmacy to pharmacy of a 1.3 grade point average. Mm. At the time, the university was on a three-point system, three for an A. And there were a number of students who had, you know, enrolled in 1949 mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. as pre-pharmacy students who got caught with that. Yeah. Students that I knew that didn't have the 1.3 and didn't get into the School of Pharmacy. So there was some effect on students, I guess, just not me, going back to that incident. But we used the 1.3 as a kind of a rough guideline. But if I looked at a student's program, and particularly if it was a student who had started off poorly, and then their grades began to get better, you know, indicating that, well, they finally caught on to what it takes mm-hmm. to be mm-hmm. successful at the university. I could use discretion in allowing a student like that into the school, even though it might not be a 1.3.
Were you generally impressed with the quality of students that you were admitting into the program during that time? Is it
hard to answer that? I think that impressed in the sense of they were good kids, not necessarily impressed by the overall grade point mm-hmm. average. Mm-hmm. We didn't pump out that kind of factual information at the time. We didn't have computers. So I don't know, I haven't any idea what the GPA, of the entering class was each year. It was quite a spectrum, though.
It's kind of interesting, though, as enrollment is declining, you guys as a school, as a faculty, are really really taking off in a lot of ways.
In that sense, it's a dichotomy, I suppose. Yeah. We were still attracting reasonably good students. I mean, they had to be good in order to be successful in our program.
To get through that program, exactly. Okay, we're going to be booted out of this room probably in about 5 minutes, so I think this might be a good place to cut it off.